Everyone can hear me. Okay, so I'm actually just finishing at King's College in London at the moment. I'm finishing my PhD, and then I'm going to do a postdoc in Göttingen in Germany. So I'm sort of advertising the two up there because I'm not really sure who I belong to at the moment. Today I'm going to be talking about inflation and inhomogeneous initial conditions and how we can look at this using numerical relativity. So the plan for the talk, I'll start by motivating the work by saying what is the initial condition problem for inflation. Then I'll go on and talk very briefly about what I've basically been doing for most of my PhD, which is working on numerical GR, and in particular the code GR Chombo, which is a new numerical GR code that I've actually been developing with Marcus, who's sitting also in the audience. So I'll talk very briefly about that. And that's the code that we use to then do this work on inflation with inhomogeneous initial conditions. So if I have time, I'll then maybe talk about a bit about future directions. To start at the very beginning, inflation. So why does the universe look the same in all directions? So one of the primary motivations for having inflation is to explain the homogeneity of this CMB picture. So the way that inflation works to do that is that if you consider the time required for causal contact before the CMB was emitted, if you just take the known energy sources in the universe and rewind, this is conformal time, and this is the scale factor. If you take, so this is just assuming radiation domination, if you just rewind it, you have a finite amount of conformal time before the singularity at zero conformal time. And since we know the CMB was emitted sort of right down here at the very bottom, there isn't enough conformal time before then for the CMB to have homogenized, for signals to have passed between different points. So we solve this by proposing that you have a period dominated by some fluid that violates the strong energy condition, and then you can have this kind of relationship between the scale factor and conformal time, where you basically push the singularity back to minus infinity. And so you have plenty of conformal time for signals to pass between different regions. So because now what we want is this transition point, we can't just have a cosmological constant. We can't just stick in a cosmological constant. We need something that switches on and off. So to get that kind of dynamical switching, we use a scalar field. So we propose a scalar field which has a non-trivial potential. So this potential then sources the cosmological constant during inflation, and then at some point it turns off. And the way that was originally proposed was that it was some kind of Higgs-type potential with the inflaton up here and then falling down into here at the end. But for various reasons, that doesn't quite work. And so what you end up with is this familiar sort of slow roll inflation picture, where you say you start with your inflaton here, and it rolls very slowly along here. And during this period, you have a roughly constant V of phi. So you have basically a cosmological constant. And then at some point, it falls down into here and turns off. And you get reheating potentially if it oscillates down here. So this is a kind of the solution to the horizon problem. But if you notice, you're often sort of looking at a picture like this, but this picture is for all of space. So you're kind of assuming that this applies at every point in space. So space is homogeneous, and you have your inflaton being at the same point in field space across the whole space. So what you would really have in reality is you have a picture like this for each point in your space. So you would have a point here where the inflaton might be a little bit lower down, and you'd have a point here where it might be over here. And so in what we would think of as a sort of general initial condition, you wouldn't have this everywhere. You'd have something where it has different values at different points. And so that sort of raises a question. Well, why do we always think of it like this? Why do we always look at the homogeneous case or with sort of small perturbations? If we're doing that, then it's a bit perverse because we're already making things quite homogeneous at the start of inflation. So why do we need inflation to make things homogeneous at the end of inflation? So what we really want is to have a situation at the start where we have really general initial conditions, and we show that even in those general initial conditions, we can drive ourselves towards an inflationary period with a potential like this one, and end up with something that is homogeneous. And so that's broadly the motivation for what we're doing. So of course, people have thought about this before. And when you think about this problem, it's natural to divide models into two classes, which are kind of artificially separated, large field and small field inflationary models. So if we take large field models first, this is a kind of a typical large field model, then what you're saying is that the amount that the inflaton rolls during inflation, the amount that it needs to go from the start to get down to where it's basically has zero value, is bigger than M Planck. So it's corresponds to a very high energy scale of inflation. So if we remember the BICEP results, or perhaps we don't want to remember the BICEP results, but if we do, that was actually what they were finding with those, that you were having sort of gut scale inflation was implied by those results. And so they were favoring then large field type models. So large field type models are really nice from this perspective of thinking about initial conditions, because it turns out that if you do a kind of a phase space, a dynamical systems analysis, they tend to be a local attractor in phase space. So in this picture, so this is the field, and this is its conjugate momentum. And where we want to be in a large field model is about here. So we want a small conjugate momentum for the field. We don't want it to be moving too fast, and we want it to be around M Planck in field space. And it turns out that that slow roll trajectory is an attractor for these types of models. So that seems really nice. That seems like we could start with more general initial conditions, and we would still get a slow roll period. The problem with large field models is that they're difficult to fit into an effective theory. So usually we propose that the inflaton, that this kind of shape of the potential, is some low energy effective theory of some quantum theory of gravity, some string theory or something like that. And if that's what you're saying, then you should be worried about having scales in your problem which are bigger than M Planck. So if you're rolling the inflaton more than M Planck, is your effective theory still going to be valid? Potentially not. So you can decide how worried you want to be about this, but it is something that people worry about, especially string theorists. So on the other side, you've got small field inflation, and that's basically the opposite. You end up with a low energy scale. It's better from an effective theory perspective, because if you expect the sort of the scale of the shapes in this potential to be around, to be less than M Planck. The distance that you move in field space is much smaller. And that generally requires that the potential is much flatter than in the other case, which you can kind of see from how I've illustrated it here. But the problem with small field inflation is that although it's better from an effective field theory perspective, it's not actually an attractor in field space. And you tend to have to struggle to get it to stay within this nice little box, which is where you want it to be. You tend to end up diverging from this quite quickly, especially if you add any kind of kinetic energy to the field. So there's this kind of conflict between the model that looks nice from a sort of field theory point of view and the model that is actually better from this sort of dynamical systems model. So I'll take a slight digression to talk a bit about numerical GR and GR Chombo. So numerical GR seems like it might be a nice way of looking at this picture. So if you're doing numerical GR, you're solving the Einstein equation. So what you do is you slice your space up into these hypersurfaces. So here they're two-dimensional, but obviously they represent the whole of three-dimensional space. And then you evolve them forward in time. So talking about the initial condition problem, that would correspond to taking your initial data on this slice. So you're putting on this slice all the field values at each point and their conjugate momenta at each point, so how they change in time. And then you're going to have to put all of the metric variables onto this spatial slice. And you have some freedom of how you do that. So you have some gauge freedom but you also are constrained. So you have the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint that say you basically can't put anything you like on this. Once you've specified the energy configuration on this slice, you're going to have to specify something consistent in terms of the metric variables. If you haven't seen this before, so you are solving the full Einstein equation, but we don't tend to evolve in the formalism that we use. We don't tend to evolve the full four-dimensional metric, d mu nu. We decompose it into the 3+1 ADM component. So we have a spatial metric that's three-dimensional, and the extrinsic curvature, which is basically the time derivatives of these spatial metric components. So K11 is kind of the time derivative of gamma 11. And so the Einstein equation, because it contains derivatives in space and time, can be reformulated to evolve these quantities from an initial configuration in space and taking all the gradients on that spatial slice and evolve it forwards in time. We actually use BSSN. Yeah. So we also need to evolve any energy momentum source. So in our case, we've got a scalar field. We just use a single scalar field subject to some potential, and we need to evolve that as well. And it's only minimally coupled to gravity, so it's just this is the this is in curved space, the Feingold equation in curved. So the code I've been working on is called GR Chumbo. So the nice thing about it is that it has really good adaptive mesh refinement, which is a blessing and a curse. A curse because it makes things kind of complicated sometimes, but a blessing because it's really good for memory and for making sure that you resolve all of your features as the simulation evolves. So what I was doing with it initially was critical collapse of asymmetric bubble shape. So you start with something that's very asymmetric and you collapse it. And for this, it's really important to have this ability to refine more in areas where lots is going on and to unrefine in areas where it's basically flat and not much is going on. And this turns out to be actually quite important in the inflation simulations as well, because as I'll show, what happens is that often a lot of the perturbations just flatten straight out in lots of regions. But you get black holes forming. And so in these regions, you need to add a lot more resolution to be able to resolve that curvature. But in other regions, it just doesn't need resolution. So it's quite efficient. Oh, yeah. So I have a kind of a movie to demonstrate the code in action. So you can see that as you get these kind of spikes forming in the middle, as you get new scales coming in, it just looks darker because the grid is much finer. And as it sort of flattens out in other areas, then it basically sort of zooms out in terms of resolution. So that's kind of a user-defined choice you can choose, but we tend to use the extrinsic curvature for the inflationary simulations anyway, and also the gradient of the field. But you can basically choose whatever you want. But it is in a way a kind of an arbitrary choice. It's not necessarily well motivated, but you tend to just sort of see what's sort of the driving the sort of the scale.
So you use the magnitude of those quantities, not like the truncation errors and sort of thing?
Yeah, just the magnitude. So the change basically across the cell. But not the truncation error, no. So numerical GR has been used before to look at this problem of inflation. So these two papers are kind of old. So the Goldworth and Perrin one was in the early 90s. And I think this one was in spherical symmetry, but this one was a full 3+1 evolution of inhomogeneous inflation. But it was kind of revived last year in this paper by Will and his collaborators, which was a really good paper. So they showed that in these large field models, you can have really large gradient energies. So you can have very very strong gradients in the field, and you still get inflation. So they're really, really robust to these initial inhomogeneities. So this is the paper that I did with Eugene, who's my supervisor at King's, and these guys from Texas, although Raphael's now, I think, in San Diego. Yeah, he's just moved. We did this paper looking at the robustness of inflation, and in particular, we were focusing on the sort of the differences between small field models and large field models. So what were the kind of the key features of each that were driving you to failure in the cases where you did fail? So we wanted to look at different types of perturbations. So you can have perturbations in the field. That's kind of the obvious thing to think about, where you have the field has gradients in it. But you can also consider perturbations in the metric. So the metric doesn't necessarily have to start off being homogeneous as well. And of course, these things are connected by the constraint equations. But there's actually quite a wide class of different initial conditions that you could consider when you think about the most general form. And what we did wasn't by any means the most general form. It was still quite a sort of simple subset of that. But it was kind of a first step. And we hope to go on and do, to say, slightly more general models in the future. So this shows when we looked at the perturbations in the field, we basically had one mode or two modes. So we were really restricted in terms of what we looked at. We just looked at varying the amplitude of these fluctuations in the field. So I'll come on to describe the initial conditions in a bit more detail, but these are the sort of, this is the one mode picture and this is the two mode picture, but just taking a slice through the three dimensional space time. So I think I've said this, we use a scalar field, it's minimally coupled. We're primarily looking at small field models, for which we use this one, which is a 1 minus phi to the 4 model, and this one is a m squared phi squared. And I don't think either of those are particularly well motivated in terms of Planck data or anything like that. They were just kind of toy models that we used to look at the key features. So just to give a brief translation guide, I might use numerical relativity language, or I might use cosmology language. And actually, it's quite nice when you're looking at these simulations to think about the relationship between these two things. So what we were simulating is this stuff on the left-hand side, so it's the numerical relativity stuff, where you can have a completely general form for the metric. And you're not constraining this to be homogeneous in all of space, or for the perturbations to be small. It's completely general. Whereas if you're in cosmology in a standard FRW universe, then you're thinking about having these coordinates, so co-moving coordinates for your space and conformal time for your time. So numerical relativity people will tend to say something's conformally flat, and cosmologists will tend to say something's isotropic. We call our conformal factor chi. So this is basically if you were conformally flat, then this quantity is just delta ij, and so pi squared basically corresponds to your scale factor, and then your extrinsic curvature k, if you take the trace of that, that corresponds to the Hubble constant in this case. So it's basically the time derivative of the scale factor. So you have these sort of relationships between the different quantities. And so obviously in this general case, there's not a kind of direct correspondence. You could perhaps take an average across space to get some average Hubble constant, but each different point is going to have its own sort of values. But it is kind of useful to think in terms of the scale factor and the Hubble constant when you're doing these evolutions, to think of different regions of space that have perhaps expanded more than others, or regions that are expanding or collapsing. So in our simulations, I guess one thing to point out is that a negative k corresponds to expansion, and a positive k corresponds to collapsing space. So in the first case, we kept the extrinsic curvature k a constant across space, and we just varied the field. So as I say, we did a fairly simple superposition of plane waves, in three directions with periodic boundary conditions. So So n is the number of modes, and as I say, we just did n is 1 or n is 2 as an initial starting point. We didn't sort of expand to a larger number of modes, but that's obviously something that we'd like to do in the future. And we used, so I said we used the ADM formalism, but obviously we didn't use that because that's unstable in numerical simulations. So we use what's called the BSSN formalism, which is more stable, but is essentially evolving the same quantities. And we used a moving puncture gauge, so that helps us to resolve black holes when they form and singularities when they form. So it basically means we're not using a fixed gauge choice throughout the simulation. It evolves as the simulation goes on. That makes it slightly harder to interpret your results, but it means that the simulations are more stable. The key challenge is solving the momentum constraints and the Hamiltonian constraints on the initial surface. So that's what really stopped us from doing more general initial conditions, is that we would have needed to spend more work on this. But in principle, there's no difficulty to that. It's just a sort of an extra piece of work. So what we did. So initially, we did assume that it was conformally flat. And we assumed that this traceless part of the extrinsic curvature is zero. And we set the trace of the extrinsic curvature to this value, where this is the average energy density across the grid. And you can see the reason for doing that if you look at the Hamiltonian constraint. So if we set this equal to zero, this term disappears. If we make it conformally flat, this term disappears. And then what we have, because we have periodic boundary conditions, we can't have that chi, that the conformal factor, is completely convex or completely concave. It needs to have regions in which it's convex and regions in which it's concave. And what this means is that the sort of this remainder bit needs to roughly cancel out on average across the grid. So this is why we set this. This is where this condition comes from, that we set k equal to this quantity is really a function of having periodic boundary conditions at the edge of the grid, that you're kind of constrained to set it to this value to be able to satisfy those. So Kij is decomposed into Aij and its trace K. So this is the transverse traceless part of the extrinsic curvature. The tensor modes, I think, would correspond to having reaching this condition, so not to having delta Ij here. Yes, so they'll be automatically taken care of by evolving the Einstein equation. Yeah, so you don't need to assume that they don't mix. We don't decompose into tensor modes and vector modes and things like that. It's just, it's all mixed up in these quantities. But the tensor modes would come in by having a more general form for this, which is something that, as I say, we probably want to do in the future, to look at more general cases. And this is more to do with the time derivatives of the quantities. So that, I think, normally would be specified by the Hubble constant. So this is like having a kind of a fixed uniform Hubble constant, whereas having this as being non-zero would be like having one that sort of depended on the components met.
And what the initial conditions for phi are going to be specified in a second?
Oh, sorry, that was on the previous slide.
That was the sum of modes.
Yes, it was the sum of modes. This one. So that's for phi, and then phi dot is zero. So it's initially a kind of a stationary configuration.
So we still have those sets of issues to deal with, but this is what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah. So this is the field, and then this is the metric components. This is how we set those. So we still have to work out what our conformal factor pi is. So now our conformal factor pi is going to vary across space. So we end up with basically a varying scale factor across space. And we do that by just relaxing this constraint because we know all of the other quantities here. So yeah, to get on. The momentum constraint is trivially satisfied because it's a moment of time symmetry. It's not a moment of time symmetry because you've got a non-zero
k. Yeah, that's what I was doing.
But because it comes from
I can't do it in my head. But
yeah, actually, I have it on when we're doing a non-constant k. But if you have zero aij, that's sufficient. So you have that, and you have that phi dot is zero. It's still trivially satisfied. That's right. Yeah. I'll remember it when we come on to the next slide because I actually have the momentum constraint in the decomposed quantity, so we can check. So the small field results. So in the small field case, as was kind of expected from the studies that have been done, it's really not very robust. So in this graph, what we've got is this curly n is the number of e folds. And this is delta phi, is the amplitude of the fluctuations of the field that we put in. And you can see, obviously, there's this power law relationship, where as you increase the amplitude, you get less and less e-folds. So you can gradually kill off inflation. And the thing to note is that increasing the number of modes actually makes it more robust. So you actually end up moving this over here so that it can actually stand greater amplitude. And we'll talk a bit about why we thought that might be in a minute. But basically the failure mode that we have is falling off the hill. So if you have just one part of the space that falls into the minimum, it very quickly drags the rest of space down with it. So as soon as one point sort of goes off the hill, you can see in this picture, this central point sort of falls down and it very quickly sort of propagates out through space. So we took this as being kind of our failure point, was the point at which one point sort of went down into the minimum of the potential. So we can see that if I run the video, kind of what happens. Yes, run. So you start with these perturbations and they oscillate a little bit, and then it looks like you're doing quite well. So everything's become very homogeneous and you think, yay, you know, I've got inflation, everything's working. But eventually, very eventually, at the corners, you start to get points that are going off this hill. And eventually, they fall off. And then very quickly, this just propagates throughout the space. So this is the point at which part of your field, as I say, has fallen into this minimum here, and you've ended inflation. And we found that this is really can be understood very easily without even considering gravity. It's really driven purely by scalar field dynamics. So you have a kind of gradient pressure in your initial phi configuration that's kind of pulling it to be more flat. And then you have the potential gradient, the gradient that's sort of pulling it down this hill, which tends to pull in the opposite direction. And so if you do a very, very simple calculation, you take the Klein-Gordon equation in flat space and you say, okay, I want to sort of set these effects to be equal, this is going to be your criterion for where the inflation starts to fail, is when the gradient terms can't win over this effect of the falling off the hill. So in terms of our potential and our initial conditions, this is what you get. So it's very model specific. It's not, it's not really a general result, but in terms of our potential, this is what you get. And we saw that this was really exactly what we saw. So this blue dot, light blue dotted line across here, that represents this critical case. And we see that if we start with that, the value of phi sort of gets pulled back off away from the minimum and sort of survives for a much longer time. So we manage to sort of save inflation in this case. But if we start with just a little bit higher, immediately it just sort of falls down into the minimum and fails. So as I say, this is not a general result. It's very model specific. But if you give me a model, I can then tell you at what point you're gonna fail in terms of your initial inhomogeneity. So it's kind of a way of ruling out particular models to say that they're not robust enough against.
And this blow up, so this is the question that you check convergence and all that.
Yes. Yeah, so we check that, yeah, adding additional levels is still gives the same result. In fact, in these small field models, you really don't need that much resolution. They were much less challenging than the large field cases where you start to form black holes. As I say, they weren't really dominated at all by the gravitational effects. So you didn't, as I say, you didn't end up needing that much resolution. Right. So in these models, the whole sort of motivation for the small field models is the shape of the potential, that you want it to have sort of features on small scales. And so this turned out, in the context of this, this turned out to be really important. So one of the key things is that in terms of this potential, it matters whether it's convex or concave. So here, as you make the perturbations bigger, you're going to a part of the potential that's steeper and steeper. Whereas if you have one that's convex, like the m squared phi squared, as you go closer to the minimum, it becomes shallower. And so so actually with this one, making your perturbations bigger makes it more likely to fail. Whereas if you have the convex case, making your perturbations bigger actually sort of ends up pulling the field back more strongly. So this was actually something that's important in these models. And also it mattered what happened over here. So as we started to sample more and more of this potential, as we made the fluctuations bigger, you start to go into this region. And if you put a kind of another hill up this region, then you give this part of the field some more potential, some more kinetic energy as it starts to roll down. And that tends to basically screw everything up and make you end up in here even quicker. So the shape of the small field models was really, let's say, really, really critical in terms of getting it to work. So in the large field case, as I say, this we found it was very robust, which was consistent with the previous studies that had been done. In fact, Will was kind enough to give us some of his figures, so we were actually able to confirm that we got black holes forming in the same kind of ranges that they got. So we were happy that we were doing something sensible. So we do see black holes form. But ultimately, they get kind of inflated out. So hopefully, this movie will run. So you can see this is K. This is the extrinsic curvature. So I said a positive value of K corresponds to collapsing space. So this big spike basically corresponds to a black hole. And this is not the black hole evaporating, which would be kind of worrying because it's a classical simulation. It comes from the fact that basically your coordinates tend to be those of a co-moving observer. That's what your dynamical gauge conditions tend to drive you towards. So you end up with your grid kind of expanding with your expanding space. And eventually, your black hole goes below your grid resolution and just ends up being kind of inflated out. So you could add more resolution if you wanted to track it for longer. But essentially, what this is telling you is that if you form these primordial black holes from the perturbation, they will tend to be very sort of sparse by the end of inflation. So a naive question that we asked ourselves was, well, can we just make these black holes bigger? So can we kill inflation by making such a big black hole that it ends up sort of eating a Hubble patch of space? Because initially, when we were putting in bigger and bigger fluctuations, you see this increase in the mass of the black hole that you get. But you can see that actually we cannot make what we called a giant death black hole, which eats everything. You end up, as you make the fluctuations bigger, you actually end up getting smaller and smaller black holes. And when you think about it, this makes sense. So in this large field inflation, you basically have two timescales. So you have the free fall timescale, which in terms of the scale factor is basically a constant. And then you have this timescale for your transition to de Sitter. Because initially, with these inhomogeneities, you're not. This is the sort of the is radiation dominated, and so at some point it transitions to de Sitter, and you can't. Once de Sitter kicks in, the black holes can't form. The space time is just exponentially expanding, and it sort of stops you from forming black holes. So this is what controls it in this initial period. So in this initial period, when we made the fluctuations bigger, your transition to de Sitter basically stops you making a bigger black hole. So here, this is being sort of the mass of the black hole you form is being restricted by your early transition to de Sitter. But But after you get to some critical point where your freefall timescale is actually less than this de Sitter timescale, so you have plenty of time basically for everything that's going to fall in, then you start to decrease. So why do you start to decrease? So your energy density is proportional to the amplitude of your perturbation squared, but then the volume from which it accretes is basically given by the Hubble radius, which is 1 over delta phi. So when you have this cubed and this squared, you end up with the 1 over phi relationship, which is what you see here. So basically, as you start making your perturbations bigger and bigger, you end up making your black hole smaller and smaller. So yeah, we came up with a formula that was based on the particular potentials that we use and the forms that we use, and we found, so that was actually what the green line is. The green line is this formula, and the green points are the simulations that we did. And they're actually quite sort of remarkably, in a way, close, because this is a very back-of-the-envelope type of calculation. So the second case that we looked at was where you would also have perturbations in the metric, so you would have a spatially varying extrinsic curvature. And there's quite a nice way you can do this to satisfy the momentum constraint. So here's the momentum constraint again. So if you have a constant k, this term disappears. If you have aij is zero, this disappears. And so this is how you get, in the other case, this is how you trivially satisfy the momentum constraint. But then in this case, to make it so that we actually had a varying k, as you see here, what we did is... So that's the eta. This eta here is this eta here. You end up with the this kinetic part, and that we set to be a constant. Then you get the sort of spatial derivative of k is related to the spatial derivative of phi. And so if you have a spatially varying phi, you get a spatially varying k. And again, you still have this constraint from the Hamiltonian constraint, which you still need to solve, that you basically need your average value of k to be at a certain level to balance with the energy density, and so that you still can use periodic boundary conditions. But you still have this sort of freedom to be able to make some regions collapsing and some regions expanding, which was quite interesting. So when we did this, what we saw is that, as you might expect, you can make black holes much more easily. So this was from a simulation where if you hadn't had varying k, where you just had k as a constant everywhere, you wouldn't have formed a black hole. But when you have this initial part in the center, so the white parts are initially collapsing, you end up getting a black hole in the center. So we still ended up with some part of the space-time being inflationary, so you're still not sort of killing inflation everywhere, but you did end up, as I say, much more easily having these regions that collapse. And that was really consistent with these previous analytical studies by Barrow and Tipler and Teban and Senatore, where they looked at the type of topologies that could support this kind of transition. So the basic argument goes that if you want to start off with your space-time, it's easier if I draw. If you want to start off with your space-time overall expanding in one dimension, that kind of looks like this. And what you want to go to is something where you're saying that your whole space-time is collapsing. So you're gonna go from something which has this negative extrinsic curvature to something that has a positive extrinsic curvature overall. And at some point, you're going to need to go through a surface that's a maximal hypersurface where your k is zero.
The space that the fact that slices are doing that may not have anything to do with what the space is doing itself. So this you can, I can literally choose a slice here, flat space, and with that space. So you need to. It's a tricky business. It's a type of big issues with.
Yes. That's completely true. Yeah. So their explanations were far more rigorous than my picture, and they looked and so I think this initial paper was just sort of stating this mathematical argument, and this second paper was showing that it was true where you started off with a sort of average an average negative value of K, that it would still be true. So you might have some regions that are collapsing and some regions that are expanding, but as long as the net sort of average across the surface was expanding, you would always end up with some region that was still expanding in the future.
Related to Lucy's question, so I mean, like this extended curvature is a slice-dependent thing.
Yeah.
So, and in your other cases where you start with constant k and your t equals 0 times slice, it quickly evolves to having non-constant k in your slice, right?
Yes.
Is there some like observable way to see that these space times with the non-constant initial k are sort of qualitatively different than the other ones?
You mean that it's not just sort of a gauge?
That I can just like maybe take a later time slice of like the first class that corresponds to one of these or
tilted.
Yeah. Like just
yeah. Yeah, good question. So it's probably true, yeah, that you could compare. So it's true that when you start off with the initial constant k, you later go to one where it's not initially constant. So you could imagine that there's some correspondence between the two, that these varying extrinsic curvature ones are some sort of, are some later time of the other set. I would say that that's possible. I guess the only point of having this is that it's kind of a starting point. Like it's a way of choosing how much of the initial spacetime is in each kind of region for your starting point. So you have kind of a one parameter family that you can vary and then plot the results of that. But I think it's a good point. It's possible that they are just related by, that one could evolve into the other.
But then, the point is no criteria based on what each individual slicing is doing can tell you really anything with respect to this, trying to resolve the issue. So unless you have a way to define special slices that, for whatever reason, you believe they are more sensible, like constant surface levels of your inflator or something. I don't know what these results mean. So if you're barrel and deeper show that maximum require positive 3R, I can draw a positive something that satisfies that. I have in flat space time, and so space time is perfectly fine. I just choose a slice to do whatever I want.
Can you interpret this result in other gauges, or there is no way to go to homology there?
So it's difficult to think of going to a specific gauge, because what you're using is this dynamical gauge, which is changing all the time. So it's true that you need to think about whether your results are gauge independent. So certainly in terms of formation of black holes. The sort of formation of a black hole and its mass is gauge independent. So that can tell you that it's not just a gauge effect. It's a fair point that other kind of things, when you look at these simulations, you shouldn't necessarily just take the results and say that this is...
Yeah, it's very strict trying at this point, but when you look at the formation of black hole, you're looking for an important horizon, and that's very much gauge dependent. So that also won't happen, unfortunately. So when we have to really... define some observers in some particular way, and then what Gasol was asking, you're right, your simulation is picking some slice for you, but you can always then remap to some particular set of observers that for whatever reason you define them in some sensible way.
Okay, thank you. In summary, we found that a small field was, as expected, not very robust to subdominant gradient energies. So this subdominant gradient energies, that's saying that compared to the cosmological constant, the kind of the value of V of phi, your gradient energy was much smaller than that. That seems like it makes small field very not very robust, but just to point out that we did only use sort of one or two modes, and we saw that adding lots of different modes does make it somewhat more robust. So in that context, you can't just claim that sort of this makes small field inflation not work. What you would want to do is sort of test it with a number of different modes. So in the large field case, it was consistent with what we'd seen in previous studies, that it was very robust even to dominant gradient energies. We saw that we couldn't get sort of bigger and bigger black holes. So as you made these perturbations bigger and bigger, if the space was approximately flat, so this was kind of a function of having our periodic boundary conditions, then you would end up with sort of smaller and smaller black holes, in fact. And finally, that varying K doesn't kill inflation as long as, on average, at the start, there was some, on average, expansion. So in future work, we want to look at more general initial conditions. So we'd like to look at non-conformally flat cases, parts where the traceless part of Kij were non-zero, multiple modes, potentially looking at where you had lots of different fields that were contributing to inflation, and constraining the inhomogeneities using some of the rules on the CMB. Thank you.
Your key findings on small field and large field inflation. So for the small field cases, you found that like inflation would fail to happen if you had these fluctuations in the field that sort of felt the bottom of the potential rate. But for like the large field cases, you're saying sort of your average value is many Planck value field values away from the bottom of the potential. I mean, did you consider initial conditions that had such large fluctuations that they would have seeing the bottom of the potential
Yeah, so we had ones, which touched the bottom, and they ended up, as I say, being kind of pulled back into a fairly homogeneous initial condition, and then it really depended, sort of the number of e-folds you got depended on how far your average value was away from the minimum. So provided you were starting with the average value far enough away from the minimum to give you the right number of e-folds, even if you had these really big fluctuations that took you sort of right down to the minimum, you would still end up with sufficient parts of the space-time expanding.
Okay.
All right. So any more questions? It's been connected again.